Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Last year, more than 37,000 people were diagnosed with cancer here in Wisconsin. That's according to the American Cancer Society. And odds are cancer has affected your life in some way, and it's also likely you've run into myths about cancer. And we're going to be talking about cancer misconceptions to begin the show today with our guest, Sarah Cotilla. She is the Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Sarah's leading a workshop on the misinformation around clinical trials at UW Health's annual Fall Cancer Conference. And we want to hear from you. When you hear a fact about cancer, how do you recognize misinformation? Or maybe you're curious about how clinical trials are conducted. Give us your questions and comments. Maybe you've experienced a clinical trial or had a loved one. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Sarah Cotilla, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me. It's a great opportunity to be here and share this information with you and your listeners.
Well, I tell you what, you're a clinical trials navigator manager at UW-Carbone Cancer Center, which is, by the way, a mouthful. it's a job I'm curious about. What are you responsible for?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're correct. It is a mouthful, Larry. So I am, to simplify it, I am a nurse and I work in the Clinical Trials Navigation Office at the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center. So what my team and I do is we help provide education, outreach, and resources to patients, families, and referring providers around clinical trials. We also help pre-screen or review patients' information, their medical information, to see if they could potentially be eligible for a clinical trial at UW-Carbone.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's worth it to define what a clinical trial actually is. I mean, I think all of us have some sort of idea about it, but in your mind, what is a clinical trial?
Yeah, clinical trials really are studying new treatments for disease in human participants. But, you know, as far as clinical trials in cancer care, we're looking to improve our current treatments, whether that be from an outcome measure of how people respond to treatments or even to make the treatments more tolerable from a side effect and toxicity standpoint.
How do you decide... Or maybe I shouldn't put it that way. How do you help your patients decide whether to participate in a clinical trial?
That's a great question, Larry. So I think what I share with patients and providers are that clinical trials are other treatment options that patients can always consider. So anytime a patient needs a new treatment, there could be standard of care treatments or the standard that's been used to treat a certain type of cancer, but there may also be clinical trials that are out there that are looking at new ways to treat cancer. And I think that, you know, clinical trials are always optional. That's something for patients to keep in mind. No one can ever force you to go on a clinical trial or make you participate. It's an option to consider. And sometimes clinical trials can give patients more options for treatment.
Yeah, I had a friend who went through a clinical trial at UW about 8 years ago. His thought was, he had pancreas cancer, fourth stage. And his thought was maybe it wouldn't help him, but he felt like it maybe helped somebody else down the road.
And I think you really hit the nail on the head. I think participating in a clinical trial is really a personal choice. You know, of course, most people want a treatment that's going to help them, but I do think that some people think, you know, I would like to contribute to science and to help those that come after me with these kind of diagnoses and how we improve the treatment. And I think another important topic to just touch on briefly, besides the fact that clinical trials are always voluntary in nature, is that There's a lot of myths out there that clinical trials are only a last resort, and that's not true. There can be clinical trials at any stage of cancer treatment, and it can be for early or late stage disease. It can be pre or post-surgical, but I always encourage patients and their providers to kind of take a pause and look anytime there's a fork in the road of a patient's treatment or a new diagnosis to see what all the options are out there.
There have to be some ethical considerations in place when there's a clinical trial.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, part of what will be discussed at the Fall Cancer Conference are there are a lot of misinformation, myths, and misbeliefs out there around cancer care. I think some of them have stemmed from things that have happened historically and things that we need to acknowledge probably weren't done in the most ethical manner. But today we have a number of checks and balances for patients that are going to go on clinical trials. You know, we have our medical ethics team, our institutional review boards, all these people that are checking to make sure that, you know, minimal risks are being undertaken on clinical trials and that the benefits are outweighing the risks and that we're, you know, minimizing any potential harms to patients.
And what's it like for the patient to be part of it?
Absolutely. I don't know that I can fully answer that because I'm not a patient and I think everybody's individual experience is different. But I think that what a patient can expect is they're going to have a team of, you know, their healthcare provider and many research staff that are overseeing their care and really making sure that they're checking in and they're, you know, following along with the patient's care to see how they're doing and how the treatment's working.
So as you've indicated, there's a large amount of misinformation surrounding cancer there, and there are countless stories about a new cure, a new treatment, or maybe there's a new suspected carcinogen. I can think of examples in both of those cases. Why is that?
You know, I think some of the misinformation and myths do stem to things that have happened historically. I think I would be amiss not to acknowledge that there have been awful experiences in clinical research historically. You could think back to World War II when the Nazis performed unethical experimentation on prisoners in the concentration camps. Even more recently, you know, a well-known unethical study is the Tuskegee syphilis incident where black men were told they were just being treated for bad blood and actually they were following them for syphilis. And when a cure became available, it was never given to them. So I think that a lot of the misinformation and myths may stem from things and the mistrust in the medical community that's happened because of some of these historical events.
Yeah, I was thinking about a couple that I know or knew. The wife had cancer, and it was terminal, and there was a treatment being proposed out of Mexico, I believe it was, that the doctors told the husband that and the wife that this was not going to help, that it was in fact a scam. But the wife still wanted to do it, and the husband just put his foot down on it. And he later told me, he says, it's the only argument we ever had in our whole marriage. And he felt so bad about that particular circumstance. They didn't do it, and she passed away. But she was going to pass away regardless. And it could have been a very, very tough time. So when you have misinformation, you know, when there are things out there like that, the toll that it takes on the families can be horrendous.
Absolutely. And I think you really hit an important point here, Larry, is that, you know, especially in cancer care, people people want a cure, and people that need a cure are vulnerable. And there's a lot of information out there in anything in media right now, but especially in cancer and cancer care. And I think it's hard for people to dig through, you know, what's true, what's not true. I think even when you look back historically, you know, 100 years ago at the beginning of the 20th century, part of the reason the FDA was formed was they were looking at misbranded and lower quality items that were being sent across states and trying to get a handle on that. And even in 1937, after, you know, 100 and some people died of a solvent that was used in an elixir, the Federal Drug and Cosmetics Act came about to try to make people look and test the safety of items so that they weren't just being sold alternatives that were not helpful and potentially lethal.
So what are some other misinformation, examples of misinformation or myths around cancer in clinical trials?
Yeah, so I think one of the big ones that probably a lot of people have heard, is that, you know, there's a cure for cancer and that the big pharmaceutical companies are hiding that so that they can continue to make money off of cancer treatment. And I think, you know, when you really break that down on a number of levels, you know, that statement in general would go against a lot of moral and ethical obligations in the healthcare community. It would directly go against the Hippocratic Oath that the physicians take. And I think on a personal level, you know, everybody knows someone with cancer. And so it would really conflict with personal interest and also just our life's work. But, you know, even for people that still question it, there was a gentleman by the name of David Robert Grimes that in 2016, he was a physicist and cancer researcher at Oxford. And he looked into models of like conspiracy theories and looked at the number of people that would be involved and the duration that those secrets could be kept. And, you know, a lot of work goes into cancer research and finding treatments. And what they've seen is that, you know, by his calculations, which were, you know, good estimates, that around 714,000 people would have to be involved if there was a cure for cancer. And, you know, by his modeling, he looked at how long it would take for someone to spill the beans, per se, on that. And some of the modeling was used off of things. You know, a lot of times there's not information on conspiracy theories, but it was used from things like the Tuskegee incident and all of and other things like Snowden's NSA exposure. And so he found things like, you know, it would take less than 1,250 people to keep a secret for 10 years. And I think when you see that information and that modeling, even statistically, it would be really hard to keep that a secret if it were true. I think other myths that are out there are some that I've mentioned already, you know, that clinical trials are a last resort, that trials mean no hope, that a clinical trial won't help me. I've had people say, you know, I need treatment, not a placebo. I don't want to be a guinea pig, you know, and things like that, that I really try to share information and educate people around what the truth is about those statements.
Well, in a clinical trial, is there a placebo?
So that's a great question. I think clinical trials in general can use placebos. In clinical trials in cancer care, we rarely use placebos. Yeah. It would be unethical to not treat someone that needed a treatment for cancer. I think that when placebos are used in cancer clinical trials, often it's when you're doing randomized comparison on the clinical trial of maybe somebody, you know, a certain cohort or arm of the clinical trial is being treated with the standard of care. And maybe the trial is looking at if we add a new medicine to our standard of care, will it make the outcomes better? And so that's really where placebos are often used in cancer treatment trials.
And the average person might say, well, why do you need a placebo?
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's different phases in clinical trials. That's another thing that you know, I don't know how many people know about, but the phases in clinical trials are actually the steps that new drugs go through to be approved as standard treatments. And so the first phase in a clinical trial is really looking at safety and dosing. You know, what are the potential side effects? What is the maximum dose we can give a patient with the minimal amount of side effects? How do we give the medicine? Is it IV? Is it by mouth? Once we find a lot of that information, the second phase is looking at, you know, now that we know how to give this medication and what some of the side effects are, does it work in certain types of cancer? You know, does it work in pancreatic cancer? Does it work in breast cancer? And if it does, that's when it goes to the third step in a clinical trial or a phase three clinical trial, where it looks at, does this new treatment potentially work as good or better than what we have as a standard treatment? And so to really get an answer to that, you have to have a randomized comparison to see, does it work as good or better than what we have for patients currently? And you know, to reiterate, working as good or better can mean in terms of outcomes or you know, the side effect profile for the patients.
Our guest today, Sarah Cotilla, the Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW Carbone Cancer Center, visiting with her about addressing misinformation about cancer. It's great to have her with us today. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're addressing misinformation about cancer on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Sarah Cotilla, Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW Carbone Cancer Center. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Louise in Dodgeville. Louise, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I was wondering if your guest could speak to kind of like the leading edge of cancer research, kind of like DNA sequencing of cancer cells and using a patient's like immune system to fight cancer, it almost treating it like a virus, and if she has any insights on that.
Are there trials going on in that area?
Yes, thank you for that question, Louise. So you hit something important to talk about is that, you know, cancer treatment has evolved over the years. Historically, chemotherapy, surgery, radiation were the main treatments that were used for cancer care. And as many people saw and know, chemotherapy not only kills the bad cells in cancer and the fast-growing tumor cells, but it can kill other fast-growing healthy cells, which is why people, you know, have problems with their stomach and nausea and losing their hair and things like that. And what we've found through the years is that there are more targeted ways to treat cancer. Something that we look at right now in clinical trials is that we're looking at, you know, could a patient be eligible based on the genomic mutations in their cancer for targeted treatment? And what the targeted treatment can do is it can target the drivers in those mutations or the drivers of the cancer. So one way to think of that is, you know, historically we treated cancer based on the site it originated from. You know, you treat a breast cancer like a breast cancer, pancreatic like a pancreatic cancer. But what we've found through the years and through some of this genomic testing is that some of these cancers have similar mutations that can drive their cancer. And so if you have a breast cancer and a pancreatic cancer that have a similar mutation, you may treat them with the same targeted medication versus just treating it on the site of origination to help focus on what is driving that cancer. Immunotherapy is another important new treatment that has come about in you know, recent times. And that's been important too, because that really revs up a patient's immune system to help recognize the cancer and hopefully, you know, rev up the immune system to attack the cancer. And it has different toxicity and side effect profiles. And that's important to keep searching out for patients to find better outcomes and less toxicities.
Yeah, Louise, thanks. Good question. Thank you so much for calling. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. What role can health professionals play in combating cancer misinformation?
That's a great question, Larry. I think there's so much out there. And, you know, as I worked on my talk for our upcoming conference, I thought about the drivers of misinformation, myths and misbeliefs that are out there. And I think that, you know, there's so many things and so many resources are at our fingertips right now. You know, there used to be a lot, and you certainly are more of an expert on this than me, but there used to be more print media. There used to be, you know, more editors and checks and balances and a lot of media resources. And of course, with the rise of social media and influencers and all that, I think that, you know, information can get out there quicker and be at people's fingertips. And so it's really important to look at the sources, you know, to look at, is it good medical information? I think a lot of times, you know, when news and media put out stories, they kind of simplify it. And so it doesn't talk about, you don't hear about like the research that went on before that or the research that failed. You're just hearing about the breakthroughs. And so I think it is hard to decipher that, but we, at the University of Wisconsin in my office, are always providing patients and family members with resources for information around cancer, but also clinical trials, and really are looking to continue that outreach, whether it be, you know, through talking at support groups or printed material or whatever it may be. We really recognize the need to be viewed as Wisconsin's cancer resource and to help people find that information that they're looking for.
What, or I should say, how can misinformation about cancer affect people's decisions about their health? I mean, I gave an example, I think, a little earlier, but I mean, this can have disastrous effects.
It can. And I think, you know, unfortunately, a great recent example of that is, you know, with the COVID pandemic, a lot of people were scared to get the vaccination, and it was affecting a lot of minority populations, you know, five times as much as it was affecting others. And I think because of, you know, the history of mistrust and distrust in the medical community, it really played a part in some of the misinformation that was, you know, out there and the misbeliefs. But I think we need to acknowledge that and do a better job of trying to help people understand how clinical research has evolved and what the checks and balances are, and that it is voluntary in nature, and that a patient always has a choice of whether they want to participate in something. But I think really continuing to seek out resources is an important part of it, and making sure those resources are reliable.
Jean in Ladysmith, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jean.
Hi. This is pertaining to the immunotherapy discussion and the very good questions that the lady just asked a couple of minutes ago. I am a survivor of colon cancer as of 1 year ago, and my tumor was one of those genetic tumors that responds a little better to immunotherapy than it does to conventional chemotherapy. And my doctors tried to get me into a clinical trial, but up here in northern Wisconsin, it's kind of limited as to our opportunities. They have them, but we were too late in applying because of the timing of when they diagnosed my cancer. And so I did conventional chemotherapy. Unfortunately, I am in remission, but I had some side effects that are semi-permanent or permanent. And I wondered, he said that immunotherapy is on the verge of being approved as a standard therapy that would be covered by medical insurance and not have to be a clinical trial. And I wondered if she had any idea what was going on with that or how I can help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Jean, and I'm glad to hear you're doing well right now. And I have a personal interest in the piece you speak about of being a good distance from a cancer center. I grew up not far from you in small town of Chautauqua, Wisconsin. Mm. And, you know, it is something from a treatment standpoint that you look at. A lot of these clinical trials are available at big academic medical centers, and not everybody has access to those geographically or financially. And I think it's important that we continue to look at ways that we can decentralize clinical trials. That's been something, you know, new that we've talked about in cancer care in general. How do we get the trials to the patients? And I think we continue to look at that. I think as far as, you know, when a treatment is approved, as in immunotherapy, it depends on the disease, it depends on the use for it. And I think that, you know, oftentimes those clinical trials, like I mentioned, are going through the steps or phases to finally send an application to the FDA to have it approved as a standard treatment. And the clinical trials are what are giving us the information that is something that should happen. And so I think, you know, it's important that we have patients participate in clinical trials, because it gives us that information to be able to bring these new treatments to patients as standard treatments, so they're not having to travel and they can be available to everyone.
Yeah. Jean, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff wonders, are people ever paid for participating in clinical trials?
That's a great question. So as anytime a patient or a person decides they want to participate in a clinical trial, they'll go through something called an informed consent process. And during the informed consent process, you'll hear about things like, you know, what is the purpose of the study? Why did they decide they wanted to run this clinical trial? What are the potential risks and benefits? Are there alternatives to going on the trial? And also you can hear about, you know, what are some of the logistics? You know, how often do I have to be seen? How is the medication given? But in that, you'll hear if there's any costs or any compensation for clinical trials. I think that historically, you know, that's been an ethical question to consider too, because you don't want to coerce people into participating in clinical trials by paying them. But I would argue on the flip side that sometimes having, you know, financial compensation for participants on clinical trials can equalize the playing field a little bit, where, you know, maybe if people are having to travel, as Jean was just saying, living a good distance from the hospital where trials are being run, or people have to take time off work or they need childcare, that can equalize the playing field for a lot of people. And I think the other piece that we look at nowadays too is that, you know, we do rely on participants and volunteers for clinical trials. And so sometimes healthy volunteers take part in clinical trials, not necessarily cancer treatment trials, but, you know, new drug trials, those phase one trials, and they are often paid for their participation, and sometimes quite well. And so kind of trying to, you know, talk about dispelling the myth of you're not a guinea pig in a clinical trial. There are now people that are self-professed professional guinea pigs, or self-proclaimed professional guinea pigs. And they use that as, you know, they're getting paid kind of to endure something versus produce something. And that is what they do. They'll jump around trying to find clinical trials and being reimbursed for them. And I think there's a lot of questions around the ethics of that, and just, you know, how the constructs are set up and what implications that could have as well.
And typically, if you're involved in a clinical trial, the clinical trial portion of that is, you're not going to be paying for that.
No, people ask about that a lot, and that's a great question. Like, what are the costs associated with participating in a clinical trial? And you know, I'm certainly not the financial expert or the insurance expert on all of this, but they're kind of broken down in two ways. There's some costs that are considered research, and then there's some costs that are considered kind of standard of care costs. So anything that pertains to the research, whether it's the study medication, whether the study requires that, you know, a person have serial EKGs with their heart rhythm to study the medication. Some of those things will be covered under research and paid for by the clinical trial sponsor. On the flip side, things that a patient would need regardless of whether they're on a clinical trial or not, like, you know, maybe if they were getting imaging for their or x-rays and CTs for their disease every 8 weeks, regardless of whether they're on a clinical trial or not, that would continue to be billed to the patient's insurance. And so that's kind of how the costs break apart. Anytime a clinical trial is being built, you're trying to limit the out-of-pocket expenses that could fall on a patient. But of course, as we know, in the U.S., everybody's insurance varies so much and can dictate, you know, where patients can be seen for treatment, and just their coverage can be different at different places and based on their insurance in general.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, a minute or two ago, you mentioned guinea pigs. How do we associate, or why do we associate guinea pigs with clinical trials?
That's a great question. And the guinea pig got pulled into it a long time ago, Larry. So I think that, you know, guinea pigs were actually first introduced and originated from South America near the Andes, and the Incas were the first people that kind of domesticated them. They eventually came with traders, you know, Spanish and Dutch and English traders. And I would say by the 17th century, they started using them in some clinical trials. And definitely, you know, they have a lot of similarities is what they've found to humans in some things like their response to allergens, their immune systems, their hearing and ear structures. And so that's kind of how they started being used. I think that the use of guinea pigs in general has decreased as an animal subject in clinical trials, as they've found animals that are, you know, less costly. Mice are less costly, animals that breed quicker and have more offspring. But that's kind of, you know, by the early 20th century, I think that's where that terminology kind of originated from. And, you know, now, of course, as much as we try to do away with it, I don't know if there's, it's swung the whole pendulum here, because I don't know if there's any term maybe more offensive than calling a clinical trial participant a guinea pig. But now there's people that are self-proclaimed guinea pigs. And so it continues to kind of pervade discussions around clinical trials. But certainly patients are not guinea pigs. They are human participants, and they have their own free will and autonomy in how they decide how what their treatment choices are. And we certainly have a number of ethical, legal, medical checks and balances to make sure that participants are treated as humans and not thought of as guinea pigs.
Well, that reminds me, just thinking about the history of trials. I mean, were the guinea pigs among the first what's the history of trials?
Yeah. So clinical trials are actually found throughout history in a number of different historical writings. You know, even in the Bible, I think it was in the book of Daniel, there was a king. His name was, he was a king and military leader, and his name was King Nebuchadnezzar. Yes. And he had decided that to keep, you know, his community healthy, he wanted them to drink wine and eat meat. And so kind of unknowingly, some of the royal subjects objected and said they wanted to eat, you know, legumes and water. And kind of at the end, he let it go. And at the end of this trial, he actually saw that they were healthier than the people that had eaten meat and drank wine. And I think, you know, you see it even coming further into, you know, in 1747, Dr. James Lind was a doctor on ships that were coming across the sea and seeing all these sick sailors and, you know, the scurvy issues. And he really tried different nourishments for these sailors, and found that adding, you know, lemons and oranges help cure some of these sailors of scurvy. And so I think there is a lot of history and kind of, you know, that scientific inquisitiveness that has prevailed throughout history, and sometimes unknowingly, but I think sometimes just asking, you know, the question of what if we did this, would it make a difference and propel us to better outcomes for things?
Sarah Cotilla is the Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Great to have her with us today. Questions for her or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll cover what you need to know about lung and pancreas transplantation and why Wisconsin Transplant Program is ranked best in the nation. Right now, we're taking a look at cancer and addressing misinformation about it with our guest, Sarah Cotilla, Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Dennis in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, Larry, I'm calling in because I've had family members have cancer, but one of the things that people who are suffering from cancer and start on chemo is the need for platelets. People who are on chemo oftentimes have their platelet production almost eliminated with the chemo. So they need platelets in order to continue on chemo. And donating platelets really helps those people stay on their chemo and fight their cancer. And platelets only last 5 days, so people need to donate on a regular basis. And with all the people that are touched by cancer, I'm encouraging them to look into donating platelets so people on chemo can continue their treatment.
Well, Dennis, thank you for calling. Comment, Sarah.
Yes, it's super important. Thank you for pointing that out and bringing it to attention. We know that there are side effects when patients go through cancer treatment, and what the caller touched on is one of those is that, you know, chemotherapy can kill those fast-growing cells, which can include some of the patient's blood cells, you know, hemoglobin, with the red cells and the platelets. And so they do need transfusions of those. And it is important. And I thank you for putting in the plug for blood and platelet donation, because it's important for these patients to be able to receive those and be able to continue on the treatment they need for their cancer.
Yeah. Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your call. I want to turn back to the trials a bit about words. What role do words play in the outcomes of clinical trials? I think everything has to be fairly carefully done.
Yeah, I think words are important in how we share information about clinical trials. You know, I think calling patients subjects versus participants, pointing out the voluntary and optional nature of clinical trials is important. I think you know, sometimes the fear is like, what are the side effects going to be? And I think, you know, there can be side effects on clinical trials, but there can be side effects with any cancer treatment. And so really helping patients to understand with the words we use, but also making sure that they're feeling heard and that they're feeling we're looking at them as an individual and a person, you know, that we're not just looking at, you know, even how we discuss their disease, you know, a pancreas cancer patient versus a person with pancreatic cancer. They're a person first, and it takes the focus off the disease and on the person. And I think that's important as we look at, you know, how do we provide good support? How do we build the trust? How do we continue our outreach and education with patients and families?
And I suppose it might be possible, or it could be possible, that the words that the clinicians use to the patients could maybe have an effect on the outcome of a trial.
I think it definitely could have an outcome in that, you know, a trial's success is definitely dependent on trial participation. And I think if a patient feels like they're getting the information they need and they can trust the person that's sharing the information, it can help us, you know, enroll patients on clinical trials. It can help them find new treatments, and it can help us bring clinical trial success about as a standard treatment, you know, if we find that some of these new drugs or treatments are working for patients.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm wondering, I mean, you have a whole raft of information, I'm sure, but how can the public be better educated and informed about cancer trials and cancer treatments?
Yeah, there's a number of different types of information that are out there. A lot of people, of course, are on the internet nowadays. But, you know, the National Cancer Institute is a great resource for all things cancer related, whether it's a diagnosis or side effects, or they have information on clinical trials. Here at Carbone, we have our own clinical trials website that patients can access. And that is a resource that we give to patients. We also, part of what we do in my office is that we provide patients and families with information around clinical trials, whether it be information from our center or general sites for searching for clinical trials. If we don't have anything available at UW-Carbone, there are other sites out there where patients can continue to search for clinical trials. And so all those are important sites for us to share with patients. And we also interact at different tabling events at with our handouts and things like that with patients, and you know, can share information in a number of avenues that we attend as well.
And that brings me to the conference that we've sort of mentioned in kind of in passing almost. I know you're speaking at the UW Health's annual Fall Cancer Conference. Tell us more about the conference.
Yeah, so this is the 22nd annual Fall Cancer Conference, and it was started again as we recognize at UW-Carbone that we need to be viewed as Wisconsin's cancer resource. We wanted to be able to share best practices not only with our own staff, but also healthcare professionals throughout the state, as well as patients, family members, and caregivers. You know, we're not only treating the patients, but we do offer cutting-edge research here. And it's our charge to really make sure that we're educating and informing our the public about prevention, screening, best practices, treatment, research, and advocacy. So over the years, over the 22 years, there's been a number of different topics that are kind of the theme of the cancer conference. You know, they've done stuff on rural medicine and palliative care and survivorship. And this year, the theme is misinformation, myths, and misbeliefs. And, you know, it's just because cancer misinformation has become increasingly prevalent and a problem that can potentially endanger public health and understanding. And so that's what this year's conference will focus on. It is open to the public. It is going to be held Friday, October 18th at the Monona Terrace in Madison. If anybody is interested in attending, they are taking walk-up registration the day of at the Monona Terrace. It is a $40 registration fee that includes breakfast and lunch. And the conference will run kind of from that check-in and breakfast until closing from about 7:15 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon.
Give us an example of the, I'm sure you're going to be talking about misinformation as it relates to clinical trials. What all are we going to hear about?
Yeah, so I really want to touch on a couple of things, Larry. I think it's important that we first talk about some of the stuff we've talked about already, but, you know, what are the myths and misinformation and misbeliefs that are out there around cancer and clinical trials? You know, how is that information spread? What are some of the drivers of that information? I want to delve a little bit more into the historical perspectives on clinical trials, you know, that lead to mistrust and some of those myths and misbeliefs. You know, we talked a little bit already, but why the guinea pig metaphor? You know, why did that come about? What has that taught us? What has history taught us? And I think that it's important to look at the lessons learned from history. You know, what have we learned from some of these important historical events? And then really also continuing to talk about the words and the language and how we do better going forward. You know, what do we need to do to plant the seeds of trust and to plant the seeds of information? What questions should we continue to ask ourselves to help clinical research continue to evolve and help people get you know, the right information at the time they need it?
You know, clinical trials, give us some, can you give me an example or two of clinical trials that have really resulted in great things?
I can, and I can give you a personal example, actually. So I also like to tell people that clinical trials are important, even for people that are not on a clinical trial themselves. So I told you that the new treatments we get come from clinical trials. Well, my grandmother, my grandma Jenny, at the age of 84, was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And because of her age, she went through some of the standard treatments of, you know, they resected some of it, they tried infusing some things into her bladder. They actually ended up removing her bladder at one point and creating kind of a new pathway for her body to, you know, excrete waste through a ureostomy bag. And her cancer still came back, and it had metastasized, and it was stage 4. And based on her age at the time, she wouldn't have been eligible for a lot of our standard of care options like chemotherapy. And luckily, you know, when she had been found to become metastatic, it was June of that year. And in April and May of that year, they had just approved through clinical trials, because they were seeing such great success, immunotherapy for use in patients that weren't eligible to receive the standard of care chemotherapy. So my grandma Jenny, because it was perfect timing, was able to go on immunotherapy, not on a clinical trial, but because it had just been approved through clinical trials. And 12 weeks after she went on immunotherapy, she was found to have no evidence of the disease. And wow. This was at the age of 84 with a stage 4 bladder cancer, was found to have no evidence of disease. Larry, she lived another 7 years and died cancer-free because of that treatment. And, you know, it really gave us hope. It really gave us time. And my kids a whole opportunity to know her in a different time frame than had she not had that treatment option when she was diagnosed and found to be metastatic.
Wow. That is wonderful. Last year, Sarah, you received the Healthcare Hero Award from the Wisconsin Cancer Collaborative, and congratulations.
Thank you.
As a nurse, you're with people as they experience a difficult period of life. How do you consistently provide compassionate care?
Thank you, first of all, for that. And yes, it was a great honor to receive that. I absolutely love what I do, Larry, and just feel so strongly about helping people with cancer understand all the treatment options that are out there. It is, you know, the worst time sometimes in a person's life to get a cancer diagnosis. And it's a privilege to be able to stand with them and help them through these trying times with information that can make a difference in their care and outcomes. And I think that, you know, I just wouldn't want to be any other place. This is yeah. My life's work to help these patients and their families and really continue to learn from them as much as we learn about cancer in general.
How long have you been doing this?
I have been a nurse for over 20 years, and I graduated from the UW-Madison School of Nursing, and the majority of my nursing career has been in caring for patients with cancer in one way or another. I have been in the clinical trials navigation office at Carbone since 2018, and our office has had tremendous success and a lot of growth with adding new staff and just seeing the need to continue to help patients with education and clinical trial opportunities. And again, I just feel so strongly about whatever we can do to move medicine and care for people forward is what we need to do.
Years ago, I had the pleasure and honor of interviewing Paul Carbone many times. It was an honor then, and it's an honor and privilege to be able to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Larry. I also want to thank you for the opportunity and the time today. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Sarah Cotilla, Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW Carbone Cancer Center. She's doing some, and the whole center is doing some wonderful, wonderful things when it comes to cancer. Coming up, we're going to take a look at transplants, lung and pancreas transplants. I'm Larry Mueller.